Welcome to Hot Plate, a post-foodie podcast. I'm your host, Mirella Amato. Today on Hot Plate, coming to you from the isolation of our homes, gastronomic masochism, fish labels, boozy food, and eat it after it gets cold. How's it going, Joshna?
I'm well. How are you?
I am well. It's been a good week.
Fantastic. What are we talking about today?
We are talking about the various processes and compounds that make cheese taste the way that it does.
Right.
And it got me from the first sentence. The first sentence is, who would have thought that a congealed lump of curdled milk could be so delicious? And it just sucked me right in.
Yeah.
What did you think?
The title of the piece is Why is Cheese So Addictive? Right? And, you know, you can sort of interchange addictive and delicious sometimes. But the first thing that came to my mind, which is addressed throughout this piece, is because it's full of fat, right? And lesson number one in culinary school is that fat carries flavor.
Right.
Right?
I wanted to ask you about that because I noticed. 100%,
right? Fat carries flavor. It is which is why everything starts with a bit of fat in the bottom of a pan.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you infuse things, your onions, your garlic, all those beautiful flavors get infused into that fat because the fat does a wonderful job of carrying flavor around. So to me, I was like, that's why cheese tastes so good. Obviously, these folks have some deeper thoughts that I was pretty, it was pretty interesting, actually. I thought I was very compelled by this and to learn about exactly what's happening. One of the things, the quotes that I loved was the quote where someone said, never before has secondhand food tasted so good.
Right.
Right. And I had never considered. That's it. I had never considered cheese a secondhand food, but it totally is, right? The first hand would have been the milk or the cream. And then the thing made with essentially a spoiled version of the milk or cream is this mm-hmm. cheese.
I love the way that they got into all of the different bacteria and the different things that ferment. And what I found, especially gripping, and it makes, I mean, you know, because we think about cheese and there's like the stinky cheese that is very polarizing. And they really dove into this, what they called gastronomic masochism.
I love that line.
Fine line between delicious compounds and gross compounds.
Yeah, or off-putting, yes.
And that's something that I know about from beer because there are a lot of compounds that develop in beer that then react to alcohol and change. So one of the classic examples is butyric acid, which normally tastes like baby poop. And then it reacts to alcohol and it turns into ethyl butyrate, which is pineapple, which is delicious.
Whoa.
Right?
That's a little swing. Okay. How do people know what baby poop tastes like? Or do they say that it tastes like baby poop smells?
It tastes like baby poop smells. Yeah, that would be
more
accurate.
You said that super casually and I was like, oh. Let's revisit that. Just tastes like baby poop. Right. Okay, got it. It tastes like baby poop smells.
Or vomit. Another common descriptor is vomit if you're looking for something that you've tasted before and you want a more tangible description. Butyric acid has also been described as vomit. And but the example they give in the article is scatol, which I didn't know about.
I was very happy to know about that.
It's a compound that gives poo its smell. And potentially its flavor, I don't know. and they talked about it used super often in perfume, because if you use it in very small amounts.
Fascinating.
Oh, my God.
I love that. And that just, it gets over a threshold, and then you're into full-on stinky poop.
So what they're talking about in cheese is that there's tons of these compounds, and they're at such a low level, and they add this crazy complexity, which is what makes it so, I guess, fascinating or, you know, addictive. As to your earlier point.
I thought it was really interesting. The fat piece is key, but I like the idea that we are somehow in small doses compelled by things that turn us away.
Yeah. So here's the list they had in the cheese. So, and I love the names of these. Putrescine.
Ooh, putrescine? Come on.
Which is responsible for the smell of putrid meat.
Okay.
Trimethylamine, which gives rotten fish its smell. Hmm. And then ammonia, which is a bit of a toilet cleaner fragrance.
Good old ammonia.
And yes. Like the butyric acid I was talking about in beer, what happens is those compounds are then further broken down and they end up in the final product smelling nutty, woody, grassy, or spicy. But it's interesting have you ever been to a cheese factory?
I must smell a little unpleasant
in some of those rooms.
It smells super funky. Super funky. I've been to a cheese making spot. I went to visit our friends at Monforte and it smells funky. And then other places I'm thinking about is I've been to a cheese cave in a retail cheese shop.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that is to me, that is like, it's like there's a cloud of umami that hangs over the air. Funky umami is the best way to talk about it.
Well, that doesn't sound unpleasant.
It's actually not at all. And you can have a dinner inside of a cheese cave that is quite delightful.
But all of this also explains why some cheeses really are an acquired taste and some of them are polarizing. When you read about some of these descriptors, it's just like,
Yeah. And what's actually happening in the break, you're like, oh, which explains why I have my tolerance for a really, really stinky, funky blue cheese is mm-hmm. very limited.
Right.
Right. I can just have a tiny bit because to me, I can actually feel the sting on my tongue. Ooh. And it's more than I'm in for with a mouthful of cheese.
Yeah, I have to say I still sometimes have a hard time wrapping my, because, you know, these stinky cheeses, they say they smell stinky, but they taste delicious.
Yes.
Right? And I always keep thinking, but they still smell stinky. But I'm still smelling it while I'm eating it. So, and it's also the other thing that fascinates me, and I hope people won't find this too off-putting. But these parallel compounds. So, for example, the smelly feet odor
in
cheese is actually the same compound. It's by the same bacteria that gets between your toes and actually makes your feet smell. And thinking about things like that is always really trippy.
The funkiness, right? It's sort of like general funkiness about where things develop. I like that a lot, actually. I think that's super funny.
And the same bacteria is, you know, in some cases when it's on feet, not very much appreciated. It was a really interesting article. The end, because you mentioned the addictiveness, the ending was a little bit of a letdown because they were talking about the fact that some people say it's addictive because it has some compounds in it and that
ends I know. I was disappointed that nowhere there were they just clear about the fact that fat is the best vehicle for flavor.
But a really, really interesting and it's going to make me, I think, appreciate cheese differently moving forward.
Yeah. I want to talk about fish and seafood.
Yes.
Right? Because this is the thing, the issue with the state of affairs of our water is quite dramatic. And so we're paying attention to it, which is wonderful. But we've got a piece here from our friends at the CBC talking about a new study in the Journal of Agriculture and Food Research revealed that farmed Atlantic salmon can be just as nutritious as some species of wild salmon.
Hmm.
Right. And so I was like, okay, wait a minute. Tell me more. I don't quite understand all of this. And so we have a woman from, she's a researcher about this very thing. And she essentially is talking about the fact that we need nutritional labeling on fresh seafood. The quote here that has really blew my mind was, people wouldn't eat farmed salmon because wild salmon was just better for you. And she didn't understand where they got that idea from.
Yeah, it's very interesting because I've been leaning towards farmed fish because I figured it was lower in mercury, which is also wrong.
Right. Right.
So education is definitely needed.
Is a key and piece
I thought the mercury was from eating the smaller fish, you know, and I assumed farming, they're feeding them something else. So there's probably less, but no, wrong. Wrong.
Right. And so we have no idea. And it's like we are sitting at a final place after a whole adventure of broken telephone.
Yeah, trying to make an educated decision.
We
with
don't
no
really
information.
Know, right, about all of this. The thing that I thought was really fascinating was that there was no there still seems to be no mention of the fact that when we think about eating fish and seafood, we have to think beyond what it means to put it inside of our bodies.
Right.
We have to think about how it was grown, where it was grown, how it was harvested. All of these things matter, right? But casting nets versus line and hook and all of these different elements that are not mentioned at all. We're just talking about the numbers and the nutritional breakdown in this food with some, I don't know, like urban myth about the fact that wild salmon is better for you than farmed salmon.
Right.
Right? When based on what, I have no idea, right? There has been some idea, some wisdom about the fact that intentional fish farming is way too intensive and unsustainable, and it's damaging to the ecosystem. So if you are going to eat fish, eat sustainably harvested wild caught fish, because you can also just scoop all the nets up in the wild and decimate ecosystems in a very similar way.
Yeah.
Right. But technically one is wild and one is farmed, but they're like the amount of knowledge that you have to decipher all of this is mega. Right. And I don't believe that just having a label on the fish somewhere with that nutritional grid, right, that chart is not answering all the questions, and it's not giving you all of the information that you really do need to, in good faith, eat that fish, buy and eat that fish.
I agree with you 100%. As I mentioned earlier, education is definitely needed in this area, but I think you're right. Nutritional labels are not the solution, because to my earlier point, what are they feeding this farmed
fish,
right? All of the other things you described. And the other piece that caused confusion for me in terms of a nutritional label is, how do you guarantee that? Because, you know, you throw in 5 different fish, each of them is going to have slightly different nutritional value, right? It's not like a recipe where you can, it's got this amount of salt, it's got this amount of this, right. It's got this, right? What are you going to do? Test every single fish? That's also not sustainable. So I don't think nutritional labels are the solution, but something is needed, because the more I dug, the more I just found like everything that I thought I knew about fish. I don't know.
Right. You mentioned earlier, we were talking about the mercury piece.
Yeah.
Right. My sense of it has been placed in entirely the wrong idea.
Yeah.
Right. I thought that the mercury piece was about the smaller fish in the wild.
Yeah.
But it is in fact not. In fact, it is,
it's species dependent.
Yes.
It's inherent to the fish.
Right.
And it doesn't matter if you farm it or it's in the wild.
I thought it was about external inputs from farming.
Yeah.
Right. Or things like that. But that does not appear to be the truth either. Which really lends me to believe that maybe what I need to do is reach out to one of my fishmonger, good fish and sea pals, and get them to come in and really help us decipher some of this and really, get a handle on what it is that we all really should be paying attention to.
So Joshna, I learned something new recently and I wanted to share it with our listeners, because I guess I always assumed that when I cooked with alcohol, if I threw in some wine or whatnot into what I was cooking, that the alcohol would evaporate and that it was really just about the flavor staying in there. And I found out that, it does evaporate, but a lot more slowly than I thought. And a lot of alcohol is still left in the dish.
Yes.
I'm guessing you already knew that.
I did. From a couple of perspectives, as a cook, I knew that, because it's very clear that that there's still some booziness left when you do like a crepe Suzette, when you do a quick flambé, as opposed to a bottle of red wine that goes into bourguignon that simmers over, after the 3 hours that bourguignon is on the stove, that booziness is gone. You just have the lovely sort of residue of the grapes, and the fermented grapes. Whereas the crepes or bananas foster, quick pan sauces sometimes, the booziness is still very much there. And we know, because when you're taught about reducing things with booze or flambéing, the reducing especially, we are instructed to be intentional about keeping our faces away from the steam, because there's a quicker shot to the top right? With the inhalation of that boozy vapor, it can do a lot of damage. So you see, there's intentional standing away from the Pam. So right. I did know this bit, but what I loved, I actually think it's really important for people to learn. Like, you know, it shouldn't just be through the course of chef school. The other context that I was connected to this is my Muslim friends.
Okay.
Right? Because one of the tenets of halal eating is to avoid alcohol.
Yes.
Right? And that is important. As a cook, accommodating halal eaters means I can't even use vanilla extract in baking. Right. Right? Because that's a booze, that's an alcohol-based infusion, essentially, vanilla extract. And that there's no, the what I've heard like from a Muslim person was that there's no guarantee that all of the alcohol is gone in the baking process. Even.
Right. So here's, So here's what I gathered from the article, just as an example for our listeners. So let's say you cook something and you put a quarter cup of spirits in there. So something that's like, 40, 45% alcohol, and you cook it for 1 hour, a full hour. You still end up with that quarter cup having about the strength of a wine, around 12% left in it.
Wow.
So, of course, if you're cooking this dish for a few people and you have the equivalent of a quarter cup of wine in there, that's not that much alcohol, like divided between four people. That's not something that is, worrisome necessarily. But, you know, for someone who is avoiding alcohol for whatever reason, or, you know, if you're preparing something for a Muslim friend, that it's important to be aware of, you know?
And to know that the residue is very much there.
Because that's a full hour. Apparently, as you mentioned earlier, it takes a full 3 hours to really get rid of the significant percentage of that alcohol. I just always assumed, because for me, I guess I don't enjoy mushrooms without a little bit of red wine in them.
Mm-hmm.
But I always assumed I throw it in and, you know, you see it, the alcohol, and now I'm just getting the delicious wine. It didn't occur to me that the alcohol, it's still in
there. It will persist, yes. One of the things that I loved about this piece, though, was the mention that if the alcohol in the recipe is intended to be the main flavor, and you can't have alcohol, just find another recipe.
Yes.
I really appreciated the closed door there, right? Because there are certain moments in attempting to accommodate people's dietary restrictions where we just have to shut it down. We have to be like, this is, you know what I mean? If this is a Grand Marnier, Crips, Grand Marnier, we got to have Grand Marnier. You know what I mean? Grand Marnier. It's got to be in there. And if you can't have booze, then you just can't have this.
And the article also had a lot of interesting substitutions. So for our listeners who are surprised by this and have some favorite recipes with some with alcohol in them, you can go to the show notes and you'll find a link to this article that has a lot of very good suggestions.
I thought so too. They were very helpful.
Different things. But I guess what I've learned from all this is I need to open my mind to penne alla vodka, which I always thought was a silly dish, because I always thought, why would I have penne with vodka that is thrown in and then gone? And then what am I eating at the end? But if the vodka is still there. Yeah.
It's one of my favorites.
I need to give it a try.
Totally. Penne alla vodka is one of my favorites for sure.
I'm going to open my mind.
I like it.
To that recipe.
Okay, so Marilla, when I grew up in an Indian family, and I have learned that I think my cultural community of people has an obsession with serving food as temperature hot as possible.
Okay.
Right? And it is considered disrespectful, poor hospitality, bad cooking to serve anybody. And anything that is not piping hot is considered cold. Right?
People feel that way about a lot of foods.
A cup of chai on the stove needs to be brought to 3 boil rises. Mm-hmm. So it's maximum heat. Right. And there's always this clamor from my mother being like, the food is hot. Come to the table. It has to be hot. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I came across a piece that the title of the piece is The Case for Room Temperature Food, right? And I was immediately like, we don't need any room temperature food. That's not the way it is, right? And my experience,
it's not the most appealing sounding thing.
Not at all, right? When we would eat room temperature food, I remember my aunties and people saying, why are you eating cold food? Don't eat that cold food. Mm. Right. And so this was a revelation for me. One of the pieces that I think stuck out the most was that I did not understand that there were that flavors got muted in extreme heat as well as cold. Right. I know just from like making ice cream and things like that, that we have to boost flavorings because the cold mutes them. And so when they're going to be eaten cold, we need to crank it up right at room temperature because it mutes at cold. I did not know that it also mutes on the other side. And that's why, and this piece really brought out a lot of really awesome, interesting thinking about foods that are actually optimally eaten at room temperature.
Yeah. I guess, so, you know, sensory science is my domain. So I've always been aware that the extreme temperatures are not great. This being said, and I'm glad they addressed it in the article later on, my alarm bells immediately went off when they started talking about this, because, you know, food is served hot for safety reasons as well.
Yep.
And, you know, I wonder if the insistence of your family on this, the hot food is just traditionally passed down because, you know, room temperature food, if it's left at that temperature for too long, I think it's 2 hours. So
it is 2 hours.
Hopefully you're not letting it sit for that long. But, you know, I think it's something that I'm glad they mentioned it in the article, that they didn't say, you know, just cook your food and then just leave it at room temperature.
And just let it hang out.
Just eat what you want. I think, I mean, it's true that a little less than very, very hot and a little less than very, very cold is definitely a good idea. There is, you know, personal preferences as well. You know, I want my coffee to be super hot, for example. Right. A lot of this, I had the opposite reaction.
Yeah, tell me.
Well, certainly, you know, pasta is always served hot, but that's because the texture gets weird if you let it sit too long. But it was interesting because the article specifically mentioned, you know, carbonara, cacio pepe, pesto should all be served a little cooler, but they are by the nature of how they're made, because you have to, after you cook them, you have to stir them.
Yes.
So they naturally cool down.
Yep.
Right.
Fair point. Yep.
And then they talked about fats and how, you know, the texture of the different fats is important, and some fatty foods should be served hotter and some should be, chilled down a bit. And I know that from pizza. Because you never eat pizza right out of the oven. You have to leave it for everything to come together. So I guess I had the opposite experience than you, which is that the foods that I grew up with all sort of follow that pattern naturally.
Oh, I love the cultural lines are pretty great. That's awesome.
Yeah. Although definitely pasta. I will get cranky if I cook pasta and people don't sit down immediately to eat
it. Yeah. And I am so conditioned about it that it really does feel like a disrespect. Right, if there's hot food that people aren't running to the table, right, I'm just like, what are you? Come on, crazy, uncivilized maniacs, sit down. The food is hot. It's time to eat.
Yeah, but that's also, I think, just a respect thing. Someone's worked so hard to put this together, and the meal is a time to be social. If everyone's just sitting when they're ready and getting up when they're done, then it's not the same enjoyment.
Yeah, it's not at all. It's true. But I'm going to think about this more. And just think about the how flavors change as things warm up. I mean, I know we know this for things like cheeses, right? Cheeses have to breathe and that sort of thing. That makes sense. But I was like, what else? What else actually is pretty great? There's some internal conditioning that I'll have to let go of.
Fruit as well, right? A huge difference if you keep your fruit in the fridge or if you keep it on the counter.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You appreciate the flavor so much more if it's out on the counter. But it's true what you said. I think the cold piece is much more common knowledge than the hot piece. People don't always think about the fact that they're missing out on certain flavors.
Well, and it makes me question my grandmother and aunties and everything who would get so serious about the flavor in their tea if I'm serving it to them like from the boiling pot into the cup.
Yeah.
Right? What are they tasting?
But have you tried having it cooler? Because I wonder if, just like you mentioned, when you make ice cream, you pack in the flavor because you know it's served cold.
Yeah.
Maybe when they're making this tea, it's packed with extra flavor because they know it's going to be consumed hot. It would be interesting to take that same tea and cool it down and see if maybe you get into sensory overload or an imbalance.
I have an experiment ahead of me. I will report back. I like this a lot.
Science. Cool. That's what I do.
Thank you.
If you're enjoying our podcast, please support us at patreon.com/hotplatepod. Hot Plate is part of the Frequency Podcast Network. Please consider leaving us a rating or review. It helps others find us. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Hot Plate Pod. Follow me at Beerology on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And follow Joshna at Joshna Maharaj on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Original music by Dave Bell. Hot Plate is produced by Mirella Amato, that's me, and Dennis Coyne. Thanks for listening.